On this week's 51%, we speak with a New York Times bestselling author about her new work of fiction on women and politics.
You know, on the surface, it's a book that's about a sex scandal, but I've been saying to people it's actually a book that's more about a sexist scandal.
Hear about suffrage and anti-suffrage exhibitions, and listen to an essay on women and representation. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Of the 535 seats in Congress, women hold just shy of 20% of them. This gender disparity and other issues concerning women in American politics have been particularly scrutinized in the last few years leading up to and following the 2016 presidential election. In her new novel, Young Jane Young, New York Times bestselling fiction author Gabrielle Zevin tells a story that looks at how we view female politicians in America and the challenges they face in the political arena. 51%'s Jessica Blaustein Marshall recently spoke with Zevin about her new book and the glass ceilings women encounter when running for office.
Can you give us a quick synopsis of Young Jane Young?
The plot of the book is probably about a young woman who wants to go to Washington and work in politics, and she, like many young women, gets an internship. She ends up sleeping with her boss, who also happens to be a congressman. And her life is affected a great deal. Her mother, her grandmother, her daughter, and his life is affected not at all by the fallout from this affair.
Is it fair to say that certain current events, maybe in the past year, have informed and inspired this book for you?
I finished the book before the election was over.
Well,
so
then.
In a way, people read the book, you know, in a different way than they would have if it had come out at a different time.
Are you happy about that, or are you okay with that, the salience of the book?
Yes. You know, on the surface, it's a book that's about a sex scandal. But I've been saying to people it's actually a book that's more about a sexist scandal. And for me, it was thinking about the issues of representation. Why are women about 52% of the population, and yet we only have 20% of the seats in the House and Congress? Why don't women run? And why don't they win? And ultimately, the book for me isn't about just a woman who has an affair with her boss. It's about a woman who decides to run for office.
Now, what about the Monica Lewinsky scandal? Many folks are sort of likening the story that you tell in your book to the Monica Lewinsky scandal. Was that an inspiration for the writing of this book?
I did think about the Monica Lewinsky scandal. So people will sometimes ask me, why tell a story inspired by Monica Lewinsky? And what they're really saying when they say that is, why tell a story about someone so gross? Or if not someone so gross, something so gross. You know, why can't you kind of stick to writing nice stories about bookstores, which is what my last novel was about. And I'll tell you why. I mean, the reason for me is the Monica Lewinsky story was the biggest story in the world, and I think we got it wrong. The narrative doesn't really make sense. I mean, an intern cannot seduce the president, the leader of the free world. It's logistically impossible. The Secret Service alone. And so if we got that narrative wrong, and this was such a big story, if we got that narrative wrong, I wonder what other narratives about women were getting wrong.
Now, the way you tell the story from sort of the perspective of the different generations, what was your inspiration to sort of frame it that way?
Just thinking about life and the fact that you can have read a story even when you were young and then you encounter it 20 years later, and the story can seem different. So I wanted to show women at different ages. What I have observed is that the optimal age for a female protagonist in movies and in books seems to be about 35 years old, and we don't really get a lot of women as they get older in either books or film. And so I really wanted to write a book that showed a woman getting older, that allowed women to be different ages. And so this tells, you know, women's stories from age 8. I think the oldest woman in this book is age 80. We don't just stop when we're 35. We continue on.
The idea of female persistence pervades the book. Can you talk a little bit about that and what role it plays in your writing as a whole, really?
Well, I think one of the most important incidents in the book is when my character, Jane Young, the titular character, decides not to cross the sidewalk. So there were all these sidewalk studies that talk about men's behavior on the sidewalk versus women's behavior on the sidewalk going back to the 70s. What they showed usually was that men tended to walk right in the middle of the sidewalk and women tended to walk on either edge. You know, the most recent studies I could find pretty much confirmed these findings. 12 out of 17 men didn't, like, move over when somebody was coming toward them on the street. And as somebody who my whole life has moved over on the sidewalk, I find this to be really telling. It's actually quite difficult to not move over when you're so used to doing it. And so one of the most important moments in this book, and I think it's the moment when Jane Young decides to run for office and kind of blow up her entire life, is a moment when she does not cross the sidewalk. And so I think persistence is really important. I mean, this isn't really a spoiler per se, but at one point, a character of mine is asked how she managed to survive a scandal. And she says, "When they came at me, I kept coming." And I think as women, that's what we have to do. We're kind of taught to be afraid very quickly and to quickly try to make things okay. But I think there's a necessity to keep coming. We have to keep coming.
Now, you've mentioned before that growing up in the 90s, there weren't a lot of good female political role models front and center. And maybe in this day and age, things have changed a bit. Can you talk about that at all and how that's informed some of your thoughts about this book?
When I went to college in the 90s, we really considered ourselves to be post-feminist, meaning that, you know, the problems of sexism had basically been solved by our grandmothers and mothers who had marched and things like that. But I think that as many of us went into, you know, the workplace, we began to realize possibly that there were more glass ceilings and glass walls than we thought or that our mothers had led us to believe. And so when I think about that, I think about how difficult it is to be the first anything. It is really difficult to become the first female president because we've never seen what the first female president looks like. I was thinking about this a lot last summer when I was watching Wonder Woman, and I'm not somebody who goes in for superhero movies that much, but I think the reason something like that is important is because it gives a young woman or a young man the idea that, you know, hey, a female can actually be the main superhero. She doesn't have to just be, like, on a team of superheroes or the love interest or something like that. To really see what a female superhero looks like is very exciting and important. But if you think about becoming a female president, it's even more difficult. There are these sorts of even systemic barriers to women becoming presidents. For instance, the fact that we tend to like leaders to be about 6 feet tall and to have deep voices, which women don't have, and things like that. And so there are certain ways in which we default to ideas of presidents we've seen before.
Well, hey, Wonder Woman shattered all kinds of records in the box office. So
right. There was a hunger for that. There was a hunger to see that.
Another thing that struck me about the book is the concept of the internet age and the internet being indelible and how certain things that you put on the internet can come back and haunt you in the future.
There's a scene in The Scarlet Letter where Hester Prynne, before she has to have her life of just wearing her A on her dress, she has to stand in the public square for about 4 hours. And this is just horrible for her. She finds it to be devastating. And I kind of think making a mistake these days, a mistake that is Googleable, is kind of like that moment, only instead of standing in the public square for 4 hours, you're going to stand in that public square forever. As long as people can Google it, they'll always find your prior mistakes. And so on some level, life is very different now. You know, it used to be when you made a mistake, you could kind of just move to another town and start again. And now it is very difficult to escape your past transgressions or to reinvent yourself in any significant way. And I think this matters because women have so many more ways they can be shamed than men. And we should really start to grapple with what it means to have an internet history and how we can read these in more nuanced ways other than just, you know, Google and you find out something about someone and, oh, they're a bad person. They can't run for office anymore or they can't, you know, become CEO of a company. I think we have to become more nuanced in how we take people's histories, particularly when we're talking about things that are not illegal per se, but just perhaps immoral.
That was New York Times bestselling author Gabrielle Zevin speaking with 51%'s Jessica Blaustein Marshall. Her latest book is Young Jane Young. The Museum of the City of New York has an exhibition that will run through the summer of 2018 called Beyond Suffrage, A Century of New York Women in Politics. It traces women's political activism in New York from the struggle to win the vote through the 20th century and into the fight for women's rights in our own time. The exhibition examines how women navigated New York politics in the 1920s through 1940s, often working behind the scenes to advance progressive causes related to health, labor, and good government. The exhibition also looks at the central role of New York in the women's liberation movement of the 1960s that redefined women's roles in politics and government, and it takes a look at the ongoing campaigns for women's political power and grassroots mobilizations. Meanwhile, as 51%'s Dave Lucas tells us, there's an anti-suffrage exhibition in New York's capital.
It's the centennial of woman suffrage in New York, but there is no suffrage story without the anti-suffrage story. I attended the opening of an exhibit at the Albany Institute of History and Art that shows the Capitol was considered a bastion of the anti-suffrage movement. The years leading up to 1917 were fraught with difficulty, both politically and personally, for women on both sides of the argument. Not every woman wanted the right to vote. Tammas Groft is executive director of the Albany Institute of History and Art.
The exhibition that we have here really tells the story of women, the women who first met in 1894 before the New York Constitutional Convention convened and organized the Albany branch of the New York State Association opposed to women's suffrage. They lobbied to make their views heard in 1915, ultimately, of course, lost in 1917.
It's hard to imagine American women not having the right to vote today. The exhibition serves to tell a compelling story about a group of women, 8,000 in all, who were simply not interested.
And it's also connected directly to the Albany Institute of History and Art because quite a number of the meetings were held at the Albany Institute. And if you look at the list of people who were involved in the anti-suffrage movement, you'll see that many of them are very familiar to us because they're the wives of the board members at the Albany Institute.
As we toured the exhibit, I asked the Institute's Patrick Stenshorn to describe the mindset of the anti-suffragists.
They believed that the role for women in society was in the home, and their way to advance society was through charitable work, through educating their kids by raising good citizens, but not necessarily being active in the political process.
College of St. Rose president Carolyn Stefanko is a guest curator for the exhibit's section on suffrage. She notes that New York was also central to the pro-suffrage crusade.
At Seneca Falls, the women's rights movement really emerged in an official way as a movement. And so many of the significant proponents for women's suffrage came to New York, worked in New York, were headquartered in New York. And so New York really, the state as well as Albany, really plays such a significant role in both of these stories. And, of course, they're intertwined.
Albany Democratic State Assemblywoman Pat Fahey believes activists today should take note of what their 20th century counterparts did and did not accomplish.
And I think this is what we've lost a little bit in society, especially these days at the national level. We've forgotten how to listen and learn from both sides.
The exhibit runs through spring. For 51%, I'm Dave Lucas.
While rates continue to climb across the U.S., the breastfeeding push often seems to miss Black women. Side Effects Public Media Sarah Fentum asks, what's behind the racial breastfeeding gap?
In a big green park on Indianapolis's south side, a gaggle of people, mostly women, are celebrating. It looks like a birthday party.
I'm gonna put ice in those.
This is the Indiana Black Breastfeeding Coalition, a group trying to narrow the breastfeeding gap. And instead of celebrating a birthday, they're celebrating breastfeeding.
You have chips, too.
Hi, I'm Tawi Spicer, T as in Tom, A-H-W-I-I.
Spicer, who works with IBBC, is all about being natural. She gave an unmedicated birth to her son at home and says almost as soon as he was born, he started feeding right away.
He literally just army crawled right up to it and just... And he was so ravenous, like he was hungry.
Now she wants to help others learn. Despite her positive experience, Spicer says examples of breastfeeding are sometimes hard to find in the Black community. And experts say community history is a big indicator of whether or not women will breastfeed.
We don't always necessarily see our sisters and aunts breastfeeding or cousins, or we might not have even been breastfed ourselves.
According to recent federal data, 18% fewer Black women than white women nationwide ever breastfed their babies. That disparity has real health ramifications for Black babies in particular. Research strongly suggests a correlation between breastfeeding and lower rates of certain diseases, including sudden infant death syndrome and life-threatening infections often associated with premature and low birth weight babies. Those are all conditions more common in Black infants. So why doesn't a culture of Black breastfeeding exist in the same way it does in, for example, Hispanic women? Erica Anstey, a nutrition scientist at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, says a whole host of disparities add to the gap. There's economics.
Black mothers tend to go back to work earlier.
A white-collar, blue-collar divide.
We know there are a lot of barriers in the workplace in terms of supporting moms to be able to pump.
Also, Black women have babies younger than white women, and data shows younger moms are less likely to begin breastfeeding. Also,
so not all hospitals are providing best maternity care practices that support breastfeeding.
Data backs this up. The CDC found babies born in hospitals in predominantly Black zip codes were much more likely to be offered formula. And Anstey says a lot of hospitals aren't teaching breastfeeding practices in the first place. Experts say America's ugly history of slavery also plays a role. Many times enslaved Black women were forced to breastfeed white babies, often at the expense of their own children. And that history serves as a powerful inherited incentive to view breastfeeding negatively.
Breastfeeding wouldn't become a first priority. We just want to feed our baby.
That's Paris Curtis, a founding member of the Indiana Black Breastfeeding Coalition. She says the first order of business is dealing with a culture that's sometimes unsupportive.
You know, what grandma says, if our husband wants us to. So we don't really have that that connection right off.
That's what this group in the park is doing. IBBC hopes to create change by building a supportive community. It hooks new moms up with mentors through a Bosom Buddies program and puts on drop-in classes and support groups. The organization also educates dads and families, teaching them breastfeeding isn't shameful, it's natural and healthy. And there are Black breastfeeding organizations all across the country, from Detroit to Memphis to Milwaukee. Ultimately, Curtis says it's about removing as many obstacles as possible to make the practice not feel like a burden.
A pleasure, yes. A commitment that you want to make to love your baby and nurture your baby.
For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Sarah Fenton.
This story was produced by a partnership between the Indianapolis Recorder and Side Effects Public Media, a reporting collaborative focused on public health. We'll wrap up the show circling back to the theme of women and representation and glass ceilings in an essay from writer Dr. Jerry Burns.
My childhood friend Ira Richards married a woman who has broken through many glass ceilings. His wife, Leslie Richards, is the first female transportation secretary in the state of Pennsylvania. She has also had other firsts and honors that have thrust her into traditionally male-dominated spheres. And the best part of this is that Ira, a standard-issue white male lawyer, proudly announces her every achievement on social media, along with posting photos of himself upside down in uncomfortable-looking yoga inversions. Leslie Richards' achievement is nothing to sneeze at. I mean, the population of women, as this radio show cleverly reminds us, is 51%, and yet women in the public sector fall far short of that proportion. For example, congressional representation of women is at 21% in the Senate and just over 19% in the House. So, Leslie Richards' achievement is significant indeed. Because women in our country sadly still have a great distance to travel to be represented fairly in our time. But speaking of time, travel, and representation, the science fiction television series Doctor Who is breaking new ground. Or ceilings. The show, about an immortal character who time travels and regenerates every few years when the character's body is mortally challenged, or when the actor's contract runs out, will, for the first time since its inception 50 years ago, cast a woman as the iconic Time Lord Doctor Who. It's about time. I watched the show avidly for a time with my son, Zach. We started with the 9th Doctor, Christopher Eccleston, and watched it through Matt Smith's tenure as the 11th whimsical Time Lord. While I really like Matt Smith and the wonderful work he did, I never got over the loss of the 10th Doctor, the brilliant David Tennant, and subsequently lost interest in the show and got caught in another Netflix binge. I missed Peter Capaldi, the 12th Doctor, entirely. But when I heard the news about the 13th Doctor, my interest in Doctor Who was, like the Doctor, regenerated. A woman in the role of the Doctor is an exciting change. Truth be told, it's not like this was a male-only series before the 13th Doctor. There were many important women in prominent roles in the show before now. However, they were usually platonic sidekicks. So casting a female head honcho beamed the show into the Star Trek universe where a female starship captain, Catherine Janeway, headed up the starship Voyager many years ago. Now don't get me wrong, I also adore Jean-Luc Picard, Mr. Spock, and all the rest, but Captain Janeway was different. She was a woman in charge in a typically male-led television franchise, and she was a bit of a role model for me. Okay, now for the real point of this essay. As tickled as I was to hear the Doctor Who news, something niggled me about this choice. Again, don't get me wrong, I am more than 100% behind the show casting a woman doctor, but this choice kept me thinking more deeply about representation. I mean, Jodie Whittaker, the 13th Doctor, is a white woman. What about a doctor of color? Or a doctor with a disability? Every doctor thus far has been white and able-bodied. Now, I get it. The BBC can't achieve a fully representative Time Lord palette in one fell swoop. If, after a long string of 12 white male doctors, the character was suddenly regenerated as a female doctor of color with a disability, it could come off saccharine, pandering, or both. Well, I'm thrilled that the gender boundary was broken. I can't help but hear the echo of another friend, whose Asian daughter proclaims her love for Aziz Ansari's show Master of None in one breath, while lamenting that his show is a rare favorite because she is sick of seeing only white people on television. Like her, I feel two feelings at once about this. I am happy to see a woman Doctor Who, but I also keenly feel the absence of other underrepresented groups in the media. As we all know, fairness and equity across race, gender, class, and ability are very real struggles in the world, and this inequality is strongly reflected in popular culture, the halls of government, business, and beyond in terms of power, representation, wage equity, recognition, and more. We must work toward better representation in all spheres of life. Still, every step forward matters. And because of that, I applaud the show for casting a woman doctor. I am also twice heartened because I understand that they are paying Jodie Whittaker the same fee as they paid Peter Capaldi. Pay equity for women? It's about time. I also applaud the state of Pennsylvania for their first transportation secretary who, I just found out, happens to have a penchant for time transportation. Yes, Leslie Richards is a Doctor Who fan. Unfortunately, I can't tell you which doctor is her favorite, but my money is on the new doctor. I mean, one glass ceiling breaker is bound to admire another. And yes, there are still other glass ceilings to shatter, but I'm getting a little more optimistic. According to Pew Research, ethnic minorities make up 38% of the U.S. population, and this year the racial diversity of newcomers to Congress was 34%. Crack by crack, we are getting there, one ceiling at a time. And isn't it about time?
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com. She also is an adjunct professor in the Department of Communication at the State University of New York at New Paltz. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1472.